Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. My name is Andre and I'm here with Vansh, and today we are going to do our first dedicated grass court season episode. How are you doing, man?
Doing good, Andre. Yeah, really excited to come here and talk a lot of tennis with you. And, you know, as you know, the grass court season is pretty short, but this was really a comprehensive week of tennis for pretty decently big tournaments and a lot of top players in them and some good data gathering, especially for Wimbledon, which is just around the corner in about a week. So yeah, super excited to talk about it all.
Nice. A few good things happened. I think probably the first good sign was Alcaraz playing finally some good tennis on grass. As in, not that he's played terribly in the past, but now it seems like to actually starting to figuring it out, like how to play better, which is funny because he had this quote that he was saying that he was watching videos of Federer and Murray playing and trying to adapt some of that game. Somebody made a comment that he watched YouTube tutorials to play on grass and won it. So that was kind of a hilarious thing to me. But like, I mean, I think it kind of proves a point about, I guess, how malleable Alcaraz is, like in his learning process. Like he is able to, you know, just be very open about the way that he plays, which I think is like a really good lesson for any player, like, you know, just to be open to changes and tweaks on their game and seeing what works for them. Because like, yeah, obviously he's not going to be able to play exactly like Roger or exactly like Murray. And he shouldn't, because he's probably going to fail if he tries, because every player has like their own identity, but you can always like learn new things, right? So I feel like it's, and with the wealth of video footage and slow-mo shots of like so many matches from Murray and Federer and even Djokovic or Nadal, he definitely should be doing that. So yeah, I'm kind of really glad that he's won Queens.
Yeah, it was it was a pretty impressive week all around, and I echo everything you said about his learning abilities and his he's like a sponge when it comes to absorbing information and learning on the fly very quickly, making the necessary grass court adjustments that he needed to make. He has a big setup on the forehand, which, you know, which is why he does very well at slow clay, and he's done pretty well on hard courts in general. And on grass, coming in this week, he was just 4-2, like lifetime. So he just played, basically, we just had the two Wimbledon appearances, one in 2021, where he lost to Medvedev in the second round, and he was barely 18 at the time. And then, of course, last year, where he came in with a bit of an injury, skipped Queens, you know, had like a difficult first round against Struff, and then Sinner just really rushed him, and Sinner looked like he was more comfortable moving. And that's the biggest takeaway, I think, for me this week, is that how quickly Alcaraz learned to become a good mover. Because earlier in this week, I mean, yeah, you mentioned the Federer-Murray videos. That was pretty revealing, because he also said that I would look at Djokovic, but I don't want to because I can't slide on the surface like him.
Really?
I think he's talking about those open stance backhands, which he's very comfortable doing on clay, especially on the defense. And there's some similarities there in terms of how they defend, you know, both on hard courts and clay. But I guess on grass, when it's very slippery and it's just very difficult to get your footing, I feel like Alcaraz found that throughout the whole week. And that was really the key, because if you look at the rest of his game, one, I feel like he's really beefed up that first serve. He's serving consistently 130, 135 into the body, hitting his spots a little bit better. Like every time this week when he was down break points, came up with big serves. And it was like 136, 135, 134, boom, game over, break points erased. And that was such a feature of his game, along with the improved movement this week. And I think it all goes back to his first round, actually, against Arthur Rindenesh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a player who's obviously, yeah, he's a big 6'5" French player, loves to come forward, like will basically charge to the net on almost anything semi-short, and he's just going to pounce and just attack right away. Plenty of serving and volleying, and that was a tough first round for Alcaraz because he was just rushed and he was having to change directions very quickly, and just like Rindenesh was hitting behind him and Alcaraz didn't look that comfortable moving, and he lost that first set and he was within points of losing the match. He was serving to stay in the match at 4-5 in the second set and in the third set as well. And both those games he managed to hold and then just played a very good game to break at 5-all. And then, you know, eventually he won it basically in a really good tiebreak. And his tiebreak record is immaculate and deciding set tiebreaks. And it showed once again, it was reminded me of those classic type of matches where Federer, Djokovic, Nadal, Murray, like these guys, like sometimes they play an early round opponent who, you know, they're not at their best level, they're far from their best game, and they just manage to, you know, barely get by, and it's ugly a lot of the times, and it's not the most pretty tennis, but when it really comes, they stand up on their game, and then as round by round, they just keep getting better and elevate their level. And I feel like Alcaraz just, he grew so much in confidence. Like he just immersed himself into figuring out the surface. He wasn't really even thinking about winning the title, I felt like, coming into this week, even though like on paper, like he was probably the favorite, but it's like, you know, there were still some good grass court players he had to go through in this field. I mean, you talk about after that, he played, I think, Yuri Lahechka, and that was more straightforward. But then what really impressed me is those wins against Dimitrov and then Korda. Korda, especially, that's where he played his best match. I mean, just phenomenal. Look at the stats. This is a guy who's like super hyper aggressive a lot of the times, but he really like reined it in, played patient when he had to, and he plays really bold tennis on big points. And my goodness, like that offensive intent, it really pays off on grass because he's so good at coming forward, closing off while he's at the net. And he takes the ball very early anyway on his forehand. And I don't think slice really bothers him as well. I was watching the Dimitrov match and just the way he's able to accelerate with that lively arm on the forehand, racket head speed through the court. I mean, he's just able to do everything. I feel like it's all about the movement. And I think that's why I feel like maybe there might be a slight adjustment at Wimbledon. You know, maybe he might struggle in the first couple of rounds. Who knows? Just because, you know, he's likely not going to play many matches this week. And, you know, if he just gets a red hot opponent, maybe the first couple of rounds could be tricky. But especially in the second week, like, watch out, because, you know, that's when the court also starts playing more like a hard court. It starts wearing off a little bit, the grass. And that's when he really starts to find his groove again. So I thought it was really, really impressive. I mean, this was his third tournament on grass, and now he's just won a 500. He's won a title now on all three surfaces. He's won 11 titles already in his young career. And his year so far is remarkable, because obviously we know what happened at Roland Garros, where he, you know, and the nerves and the cramping and all that stuff that happened. And we were kind of robbed of a really good high quality match after the second set, when it was one set all. And you know, nobody knows really like what would have happened. Probably, you know, Novak was looking like slightly the better player, but you just never know. Like, it was one set all, one all in the third. And for Alcaraz to recover so quickly from that and come back and do what he did this week at his age, like, that's pretty impressive. And Ferrero, his main coach, wasn't even in the box a lot of the times. I mean, not at all this week. He just wasn't present. So he was with another coach. I'm forgetting his name now, but somebody will probably remind me on Twitter. But like, it was, you know, it just shows like he's able to problem solve in the moment, and he just has all these tools, like, so complete.
Yeah.
So,
I was just going to say, I was really liking how he was hitting his forehand, mainly just because, like, I thought that's like when he was paying off, like, he's watching off like Roger Federer playing, because I kind of got a lot of it, like, in the way that he was hitting it, like, just, I always found that his forehand, like, looked a little bit more like Federer's, like, in general, just because of the arm extension and just, like, the follow-through and just the way that his balance was
like
really...
Approach shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, an approach shot, and he loves going down the line on the approach, and
Federer looks very better than anybody. Like, it looks, like, really gracious as well. Just, like, the technique is so clean. Yeah. I feel like it's really similar in that regard. Maybe the take-back is different, obviously, but, like, the follow-through is, like, very similar. So I was really liking how he was hitting it, like, flat, and when I was watching him against Dimitrov, I thought he was taking the ball on the rise, cross court, really well. And I think that's like one of the things that bothered Grigor the most, because like, he wasn't really able to because Grigor likes to play long points. That's probably like one of his problems, I guess. Like when he meets like players like that, who are able to like just be aggressive, like off of like many shots, it kind of breaks rhythm a bit. And
he has that good backhand slice, and it stays very low.
Yeah.
You know, he can actually challenge Alcaraz, I feel like, in the athleticism department.
And exactly. I feel like Grigor is like played that he has all the shots. I think he's just like, his biggest problem is sometimes his ups and downs in matches are like they're too significant. Like he played
it's
like
too much of a delta.
And that's
what happens. Like he'll just throw in a really bad game. He'll fall two or three times. And
just the first game of the match, like he lost the first point and like hit like three aces and then like hit three double faults like right away. It's like, okay, that's like Grigor's matches as an NHL. Like when he's like his best, like is obviously like one of the best players on tour, like Formula number three. Has won this title before, has been a semifinalist in the Australian Open and won the World Tour Finals before. So he's got what he takes. And I think he's really athletic, as you said. And I even tweeted it that like I feel like Grigor, if he got his head like in the game like the entire way through, I feel like he could have won that match against Carlos like with some comfort, not exactly like full comfort. I felt like he could have just been like I don't know, like a 7-6, 6-4, or like a 3-setter in which like you would like maybe get a break and just win like a 6-3 in the third. I think it was a possibility, but I may have underestimated like how well Carlos was playing on grass this week. I was coming off of just watching him playing Hindenburg Match as well, so I thought, well, maybe his quality of on grass is still not quite there, but like he obviously like showed how much he learned out of that single match. He was able to, you know, get his footing on grass like so quickly. It's not a good sign for a lot of people going into Wimbledon, but the Hindenach match is a good sign in the sense that like, who knows, maybe he's gonna play at that level and like be a little bit off balance and like a player that like plays like a really solid match. I don't know, he gets like fired up Maxime Cressy. Maybe he's gonna have to go through like in three tie breaks. Who knows?
Yeah, we haven't actually seen Alcaraz play like a, you know, mega all exclusive big serve player yet on grass. That would be kind of fun to watch just because of the contrast. And you know, that's the other thing. I feel like Alcaraz is just protecting his serve a lot better than he was, and say like this time last year as well. Like it's just really up to serving. I feel like that's maybe the biggest thing is like his ability to like not panic in the moment. Like I feel like at times last year between Madrid and the US Open, that's when he was kind of like really feeling the pressure. And, you know, he was just leaking a few too many errors. He was, you know, losing a few too many service games, playing over hyperly aggressive at times where he just, you know, needed to just build the point a little bit more and not be so ambitious. I feel like he found that balance much better this week because he started to also mix in the backhand slice. That was huge. I saw a stat from Tennis TV, actually, in Roland Garros. 18% of his backhands were backhand slice. In this tournament, 45%.
Whoa.
So that tells you, oh my goodness. And I also saw...
That's tactics. More that's really good.
Block returns and, you know, a bit like how Murray used to do. Like on his forehand, he would just block the return back, deflect all the pace from the big server, you know, make the other player, like, create something and come forward. And he's so good when it comes to passing shots and just the drop shot doesn't work quite as well, I feel like, on the surface. He wasn't using it a ton. But when he did, it was, you know, so I was obviously very well executed.
Yeah.
It had some good disguise. It was tough. And I actually thought the hurdle where he might fall this week was gonna be Korda. I had a feeling like just before that match, I'm like, Alcaraz better play his A+ game, because if he doesn't, Sebastian Korda is a guy. Like, talk about a guy who's comfortable on grass.
Yeah.
This guy is,
he's got all the tools, right? Like a flat ground strokes, a big serve. Like
it's awesome. Like the two-hander is great for grass.
And I would say even like the two-hander Korda hits is on grass maybe is better than Alcaraz's. Because I feel like Alcaraz is like his Achilles heel in a way, because I think that's the shot that can not let him down, but he won't normally always be as aggressive off of the backhand. Can sometimes throw in a few loopy ones, even though they're going to be deep. I feel like it's the moment where he can lose the control of the rally. He can like become a more neutral zone if you play to his backhand.
He likes to run around it and hit forehands inside out from that corner and protect that a bit more. It's still a, you know, he can still do some plus one damage off of it. Yeah. And, you know, like we saw him do on clay and stuff, but that's why I love the slice, because that just, it just brings his forehand into play more. And it's like, you know, whereas I, like players like, I mean, Korda, Medvedev, Zverev, Djokovic, like, I mean, they would just take that two-hander on the rise and probably just sweetly time it down the line, especially Korda. Like, his doesn't have huge backswings and he stays very close to the baseline when he's hitting, and it's very compact stroke production. So if, I thought that might throw Alcaraz.
It's a very Agassi style.
Yeah. I'm just really glad to see. That was one of my takeaways from this week, like that quarter run to the semis. I was like, oh my God, I missed this guy, because he was one of the three best players in Australia. Like, entire month of January, he really brought it until that wrist injury in the quarterfinals. And then he wasn't able to play the entire, like, 3 to 4 months after. And then.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a wrist injury, right? It's like really, kind of have to be really careful with those. So, anyway, it's bad.
I hope he can make a deep run along with Tiafoe also, because Tiafoe won a title the week before. And they actually played each other, and it was a good two-set match. But I thought, either one of those guys, like, if that's a quarterfinal or something, I wouldn't be too shocked. I don't know who else is, like, really that much of a contender. That's why, like, you know, people were saying over and over, like, Alcaraz didn't play a top 10 player. But I'm like, yeah, but, you know, he played guys who were very good on grass. Divinor, Korda, Dimitrov, these guys are not in the top 10, but they've all been in the second week of Wimbledon. They're all fairly comfortable. Divinor's won titles before on 250s on grass. He's been to the fourth round.
And to be fair, like, I feel like on grass, it makes a lot more sense than on the other surfaces to say, like, but he's really good on grass, because grass is like,
it would have meant, like, let's just say, I don't think it would have meant that much of, let's say he beat Tsitsipas again, or he beat Medvedev again, or something like that. He didn't really need to do that to me.
Exactly.
To prove that, oh, he's worthy of this.
Yeah. Because I feel like the grass season is so short, and there is so little time to learn how to play well on grass, because that, when players are really good on grass, they stand out, even though their ranking really doesn't show. I feel like that's the biggest disparity between rankings and level and surface, on not surface level, but, like, you know what I mean, like the level on a specific surface.
Yeah, that's what
the grass one,
the grass court for so many years, right? They would take the results from the past 2 years, then, like, your best result at Wimbledon and, like, times 75. Like, they had some kind of a formula, but, like, they just had seeds. They got rid of that in 2021, but I mean,
I'm not sure
they had it, because
it does make a lot of sense, like, to think of it. Like, it definitely feels a little bit of, like, an arrogance ranking, like, in a sense, like, from Wimbledon to do that. But at the same time, a lot of people even say, like, instead of, like, taking it off of Wimbledon, why just don't we edit for, like, the French Open as well, or something because, like, it makes some sense, like, in that regard, because. The clay also makes that,
like,
difference.
With the clay, you also have, like, the altitude clay versus sea level clay, and you have, like, so I guess I could see it, but my goodness, like, I mean, just like his ability to learn so quickly, like, you know, before this week, if you would have asked me, like, you know, is he, like, the second or third favorite, I probably would have said maybe, but, like very hesitantly, like, I wouldn't have put him at the second favorite mark.
I'd put it, like, fourth or third. I don't even know what the second favorite would be, but.
I don't either, and I would have maybe thought Medvedev, but then, you know, like, after this week, now I can be like, okay, like, Djokovic, clear-cut number one favorite, like, against the whole field, like, it's his to lose, but then after that, I'm like, I don't know if there's anyone better than Alcaraz.
Yeah.
And that sounds crazy for a guy who has only played 11 matches.
Yeah.
His whole career on grass, but I'm like,
I would
see it in him and for anyone else.
I definitely give Alcaraz the number two position favorite, but I do feel like Djokovic is still too much point.
The thing is, if you play Sinner or something in the quarterfinal, like, that's a match I want to see again, because
Sinner Djokovic, yeah.
I mean, Sinner Alcaraz.
Sinner Alcaraz, like, okay.
That would probably be a quarterfinal if they played at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
So now the seedings are finalized. I think Sinner is the 8th seed. So if we get that, and I mean, Alcaraz, of course, now he's back to number one for about 3 weeks at least. And I mean, it doesn't really matter in terms of, like, number one or two, in terms of, like, you know, Wimbledon, like, getting the draw, because either way, like, if he were to meet Djokovic, it would be in the final, but I feel like, just as far as a confidence boost, I think it's good, like, to right away wipe off what happened at RG with that match and just, like, put that behind him.
Yeah, and I think Alcaraz is the type of player that I can confidently say that he learned out of that experience, and that 99% will not happen again. Like, even if it's like at Wimbledon, yeah, if they have to meet now, and the final could be something a little bit more of nerves, but I don't think it's going to be cramping. I think it's going to be maybe like playing hesitantly and not necessarily playing his best. But I feel like it would be like a thing of like a set. He wouldn't play his best set as he did like at RG, but yeah, I think he's not gonna cramp again. I think he's gonna come up fired up. I think Alcaraz is the type of player who's destined to play number one, to be number one, if you will, just because of the way that he feels about the game. There's like something, there is something extra that he knows that he's better than anyone, essentially, at his best.
I like the way he comes across a lot, because it's very much like he backs himself. He's really confident. Yeah. At the same time, it doesn't feel arrogant to me. Because
no, yeah, and like, it's a humble way of being like that. So it's really good to see. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, I love seeing that swagger, because you don't want to be like on the other extreme where you're just like, you know, you're just honored to play the big three every single time you step on the court, yeah, with them, and then you've already lost the first set before you're even on the court.
Yeah.
And it's like it can be endearing, like it is with Casper Ruud sometimes, but then it also it's like not the best mentality to have, right, in a big match. Right. And then also, then you'd also don't want to be the other guy who's like, you know, I'm gonna win Wimbledon and I'm like the favorite. So it's like, yeah, I feel like he has that balance figured out, and he has the right, yeah, people in his corner to like guide him through every, yeah, experience. Yeah.
I think it's some sort of like a mentality that's like, in a way, if Nick Kyrgios was humble about his tennis, like, his honor to beat the big three, in a way, you know what I mean? It's like, it's an honor to play you and beat you. So it's like, it's, Alcaraz kind of gives off that vibe, which is like, man, I cannot believe that I shared the court with you and I was able to beat you, in a sense. Like, there's a dream come true for me to beat you in a final type of thing. So I think it's kind of the vibe that he gives off to me, that he thinks that he belongs level-wise right up there with them, at least like on a given day, that he's going to be playing his best in. It's not necessarily like achievements wise, because that's like the long game, right? You don't necessarily start playing tennis to beat Steffi Graf's record.
And look, like 99% of the players that you're going to face every year during the year, it's not going to be Djokovic. So like, it's,
yeah,
like for him even to go like this year, like 40-4 on the year, like his four losses, it's like, there's only one match that he played the entire year where he lost, like, and he wasn't 100% physically the entire way through the match. And it's like, and that was when he was coming back from Barcelona and winning Madrid and Barcelona, that 3-week stretch. And then he lost to this qualifier who played an amazing tactical match that day, Fabian Marochan in Rome. But the other losses, I mean, he lost to Djokovic and Roland Garros in the semis, and then he lost to Sinner in Miami, who played really well against, yeah, him. And he was also struggling with some cramps and physical issues there. And then also the one versus Dori in Rio. Yeah. Where he was up a sit and a break, and then, yeah, and then he had some hamstring issues there. But like, it's, yeah, I mean, he's better, playing better than he was a year ago. Let's put it that way. Like, he's a better player than he was then, which is scary.
Yeah, it's just his evolution graph is so steep. Like, his learning curve is like really, yeah.
And I also want to give props to David Noor, because, I mean, like,
yeah, sure.
He's not doing that well, like, after Acapulco, after winning Acapulco, which is like the biggest title of his career. Like, what stood out is like, and that was like when he just out physical Rona and Tommy Paul in those semi-final matches. It was at his first 500 level title, and it was like a really big deal, like, just for him to like be back inside the top 20 and then like win that thing, because like that tournament was a hot, humid, and it was like just how David Noor like wants to play these kind, yeah, of matches, and just out physical and out grind his opponents like Leighton Hewitt used to do.
Yeah.
But I feel like he has a good game for grass, because he hits the ball really flat. He takes it very early. He likes to come forward.
Yeah.
Hit on the rise. He's a guy who takes almost every single ball, like, inside the baseline and just on top of the bounce, because he kind of has to, because he's not the biggest guy in the world. And he also, like, just doesn't really have that natural firepower from the baseline. So
yeah, he has a bit of a, yeah,
is to finish at net, and he's a very good ballier.
Yeah.
And he's really, really fast. And he's, yeah, like, I mean, Alcaraz had to be very creative to finish points against him,
yeah,
in both sets. And actually, there was a point in this match where I thought, oh, David Noor probably can win this first set, because Alcaraz was serving at 3-4. He had to save two break points. and he saved them in like spectacular fashion, where like Dimitar chased down this overhead, and then Alcaraz has this approach, and it was really, really windy, and he kind of just did enough on his forehand finish, and I thought Dimitar might have made that lob, but then it was just long, and I mean, if that goes in, and that point restarts, like, I just don't know, because it's like, I mean, these two played each other, and these are like two of the fastest players on tour playing against each other in terms of just pure speed, but Alcaraz just has a ton more firepower, and you know, bigger serve, and just more.
I think Dimitar, in a way, it's like, for me, it's what Medvedev would be if he likes to volley instead of play 3 meters back from the baseline. So.
Yeah, I mean, he hits pretty flat, and he's got like, you know, the strange like bit of technique on the backhand where it's like a very short backswing, but he takes it really early, and so it's like on a grass court where it stays low, and he gets that penetration through the court.
Yeah,
it's like it does wonders for him, because on clay, he doesn't have the firepower.
It just sits up. Yeah, it's just
a rough surface. It doesn't surprise me that he struggled from Acapulco to now. Like,
yeah,
just based on the conditions, I feel like this is where he usually plays his best. So is he like a top 10, 12 player on grass? Like, probably. Like last year, he probably should have made the quarters, and then he would have faced Kyrgios there at Wimbledon. And it's like, I feel like he's definitely someone you don't want to play for sure on this surface. And he impressed me again by beating Runa, because you thought like, okay, maybe Runa might get him this time, but it was just so much more comfortable on the grass than Runa was. And Runa was struggling with some physical issues of his own in that second set, but Dimitar was just so solid and more aggressive.
I like
offensively.
The thing that I find a huge quality of Dimitar, and I think that's probably some of that Spanish mentality in a sense, because he's has a lot of like Spanish background. I think he was used to live in Spain for like a long
time. He trained in Spain.
Yeah, exactly.
There in his...
Yeah, and it's the idea that he's always determined to win a match no matter how ugly it gets. Like he's got like this, he's very consistently at his ceiling and his floor like are very close in the sense that like. He doesn't really fluctuate a lot, like in terms of at his level. He's not gonna play like a horrible set and then he's gonna play like an amazing set. He's gonna play like a great set and then he's gonna play like a not so great set, but it's not going to be like horribly awful. Like he's always gonna come out, I think, very consistently well. You always know sort of like what to expect from him and what level to expect from him, unless something.
He's like a guy who's like a 15, like number 15 to number 30 lock. For like the next decade, like he's like that type of guy where it's like, yeah, fourth rounds, you know, maybe a quarterfinal or two, maybe like do still get to like these 500 finals. Like he's like one of those guys where it's like that's like the litmus test if you want to be a top 10 player. Like you got to get through him.
Yeah,
like he's especially on the faster courts. That's where he could like maybe punch above his weight, but maybe have moves like this. But it's like, there's not that much difference, because like 2018 to now, like if you look at his ranking history and you look at his results, like he's always like either 18, 24, 23, like, and I mean, like he has 7 titles, 6 250s, 1 500, and it's like he's pretty much going to win like a title or two every year, and he's going to be like in the conversation for like, you know, like a top 16 seed at a major, like that kind of thing. So like he actually hasn't made a Masters 1000 quarterfinal yet, so that's probably maybe the next.
His the next
thing. He made a Slam quarterfinal before that in 2020, but he's.
What would you see him making that quarterfinal? I think maybe Canada and Cincinnati. Good.
Yeah, probably like one of the really like probably Cincinnati. Like it's fairly quick, fast. Maybe like a Miami, you know, or Cincinnati. Like one of the hardcore ones for sure. Like none of the clay ones. And see him like maybe indoors in Paris Masters. That's the tournament always gets funky and you just the draws fall apart sometimes.
Yeah, in a way you could even like go on to win this if the draw opens up enough. So
yeah, I mean you have new Masters 1000 winners.
That's if there is a place to win a Masters 1000 if you're not like a consistent top 10 player, the place is Paris.
Yeah, if you're not Djokovic and you not won it like 6 times.
Exactly.
8 finals. But like it's I mean, I guess there'll be opportunities, but I just, yeah, like a run like this doesn't really surprise me, and it doesn't really like it. It's like what he should be doing. Let's just say
exactly.
It's pretty standard, but pretty good week overall, I guess. If we transition over to,
yeah, somebody who also had
about
like Vermeer? Exactly. The other person had like a very, very good week.
Yes, this was another week for Petra.
Her very own Petra Kvitova, who every once in a while shows up with her best tennis and is like, wow,
but
okay.
When she's at this level, man, she's,
can't believe she's
number
one.
Like, it's, like, I, you know, I'm watching these matches, I'm like, I'm just laughing at how good her tennis is. Like, it's so good in terms of like the first strike tennis, the accuracy and the precision that she has on her first shot after the serve. I mean, it's just like good luck. Like, if she plays like this at Wimbledon, which is like that's the biggest thing. Like, because if she, because every now and then she has weeks like this, like Eastbourne, Birmingham, Miami earlier this year.
Yeah,
she won like 31 titles. She's like the best player to have not been number one in the world.
Yeah,
like
without a doubt. Like, she's like by miles or ahead like of anyone else.
Like, her resume, her CV is just like, it is, it's the best, if you, especially if you take out the slams, and like you, and like let's say Venus Williams is not in the picture, like she has the best resume outside of the majors than anyone else active right now.
Yeah, Petra Kvitova is the wait, what of the WTA? It's like, you look at everything that she's done, it's like highest ranking two. It's like, how is that possible? Even
like,
though
she was like points away from number one.
She was like a match away, I think.
Like, it was. Even as late as 2019, I think had she won that third set against Osaka, she would have been number one.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, yeah, she could have had three slams right now, and it's like.
True.
And it's like, I guess grass is like her best surface by far, but.
Yeah.
But it just hasn't translated to Wimbledon since 2014. So that's why I'm like really curious. Is she going to play Eastbourne next week? And is like, how is she going to do at Wimbledon? Those are my two main questions. Because it's like, I want to put her up there with like Rybakina. Like, as like the top favorite, but like, I just don't know.
It's just a week in, week out issue. Yeah.
Like, it's because, like, oh my goodness, like Donna Vekic, like, played really, really well in this final. Like, she played really well.
And she lost like two straight, like 6-2, 7.
She lost 6-2. And I'll be afraid, like, the second set was very close. Like, she was up a break. She was even like maybe the better of the two for like most of the set. But my goodness, like, just like, if you get a chance, like, watch that match point, it's like, I think absurd. Like, I don't know how she hit that forehand and just it curls in and just hits the line, and it's like,
And I could like her chances at Wimbledon just because I think Miami is like, if we combine Miami and this performance together in one, Miami is like the 2 week event, like a fast court. So she had to do it like in I think she did six matches. I'm not sure if she was seeded.
Yeah, she did. And she actually ran through the same players. She actually beat like most of the same players that she did in Miami. Like, she beat Donna Vekic in Miami. She beat Alexandrova in Miami.
Yeah. And then
she beat,
and then you get like
Rybakina.
Yeah.
But
true. To then close the door on the Sunshine double.
But, yeah, that was.
But, and then like, you get like this grass court. So she's definitely showing she can play well for 2 weeks. And then she can also play well on grass. Like, is this going to mean that Wimbledon is going to be good? I'm not sure. I think there is a bigger chance that her level is not going to be as great as you said. Like, historically, hasn't. But,
it's just, I mean, it's weird. Like, she won, but then she just played Madrid and the French. But she was very undercooked. Like, she had a foot injury and then just played Madrid, where she actually always like does really well. She's won that thing like three times. Then she lost first round there, first round of French, and then now like goes on this round right here. And she's like, recently, because she had like a really good February and March, because she also got to the quarters of Indian Wells, I think, and then lost to Sakkari there. And that's like, I don't know, she would have been in the semis there, and then she went on, she won Miami, and then now this. So it's like, I think she's like, she's like in the top 10, and she's number six in the race. I wonder what she is in the rankings. Let me check.
Did Sabalenka play?
Number nine in the rankings. Okay. Yeah. She stays number nine, but it'll be.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Interesting to see, because she plays Ostapenko in the first round of Eastbourne, and they both won Eastbourne in their careers. And last year they played each other in the Eastbourne final. Now they're playing each other in the first round, and it's like, we'll see if that match even happens. But
I just realized Barbora Krejcikova just made it back into the top 10. So
yeah, maybe the most surprising thing about Berlin, I guess it's not that surprising just because of what we're saying with the grass and the warm-ups and just the depth of the tour, but yeah. Sabalenka going out early to Kurumbatova.
Yeah.
Rybakina losing to Vekic, which I actually was like, you know, a good three-set match. And like, it's not that much of a shock when you look at what Vekic did like the whole week. And then I guess you had Goff losing. You had Kvitova losing. I mean, sorry, not Kvitova. What am I saying? Kvitova won the thing. Who else lost? No, Jabeur lost. Jabeur lost to Niemeyer in the first round.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, there. Difficult draw.
Yeah, yeah, I think Jabeur is it's in a bit of a hit or miss phase lately. She had just come back from injury and played her first tournament in Charleston, which she won, and then never really did like an incredible run again. I think she did well at the French, but I don't remember exactly where did she.
Yeah, she lost in the quarters to Hadaj Maya, but
yeah, oh yeah,
that was maybe a match that she should have won.
Yeah,
because like she had many chances to win that in straights, and then.
Yeah.
Ended up losing 6-1 in the third, but you would tell she was just she was short of matches coming in, because like after Charleston, she also played in Stuttgart and lost to Świątek, but then like she hurt her calf.
Yeah.
So then she had like that injury, and I actually thought she might not play the French, but then she did, and then
did pretty.
Yeah, that was probably an opportunity missed to get to the semis, but it's good that she made the quarters. That's something she hadn't done before, but. Anyways, like, I don't know if she's going to repeat and get to the finals of Wimbledon again. It's a tough ask, but she's definitely still like a top five favorite for sure.
And just realized that Maria Sakkari also lost to Donna Bekic in the semifinals.
Yeah. Maria Sakkari's 30th semifinal. But yeah, like at this point, semifinals and Sakkari is.
That's what keeps her in the top 10, isn't it? So.
Yeah, I saw some jokes actually on Twitter where someone was like, hey, she's living the dream because she's not working on Sundays. That she's a multimillionaire. She found the perfect work-life balance.
She hacked the system.
No, but I mean, like...
It's pretty unfortunate, like, to be fair. Like, it's like, as a tennis player, I mean, she's going to look back in her career and... The one regret.
I like that she can joke about it, like herself on Twitter.
Yeah,
and she's like, you know.
I mean, there's plenty of good things to take. Plenty of positives in her life. So yeah.
But yeah, it was just one of those really dominant weeks from Kvitova, really, because she beat Pliskova in the first round, and then she also beat Garcia in the quarters, Alexandrova in the semis, and and then Vekic in the final. And Vekic is another one who I like to see do really well, because she used to be pretty good in 2019. It was a top 20 player, but then just suffered a lot of injuries, and then she really turned around last October in San Diego, where I was actually there. She lost to Świątek in a final in three sets at 500 level in San Diego, and ever since then she's been on the rise, like back inside the top 25 now. So it's like,
speaking of Świątek, she didn't play. She's not gonna play an entire grass season. Did she play a tournament, like a warm up tournament? No.
No, she's playing. She's playing this week, upcoming week in Bad Homburg.
Oh yeah, it's true.
For the 250 there.
Interesting.
It would have been good if she played this week, but I also get it because she just won Roland Garros again, and then she was also at the Rafael Nadal Academy.
Yeah, you wonder how much she believes she can win Wimbledon. But
I think her belief is a little higher than it was last year. And yeah. She's probably going to do a bit better than last year. That's kind of my hunch, just because, her game is not really made for grass, and you don't really look at it. Like, I feel like it's an easier transition for an Alcaraz, but you look at her, it's like she's so fast. She moves so well that at some point it's going to translate.
Yeah.
And I think like last year it was just like a total write-off because she was coming off of that 35 match winning streak and like six tournaments won in a row. It was just like she was just tired, you know? Like she came into that tournament just completely undercooked, like unprepared. And she probably played the worst match of her slam career against Cornet, and Cornet played like lights out in that third round. But like I wonder how she's going to do this week. She doesn't even need to win the tournament. I would say like two or three matches and then just like...
I wonder...
That's the danger. If you go all the way this week and you win those four matches and then like you have the quick turnaround.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. I would say, I think Rybakina is... I think she's the favorite still. I would place probably Sabalenka as the second. I'd go Świątek third favorite, mostly because she's number one and how good she is, like all the things that you said, right? The only thing for me is like just how well she's going to play on grass, like on, you know, I think that's probably going to be the question for me. But
yeah, I think I have the same order as you, and Rybakina is playing again this week in Eastbourne. Sabalenka, not really, but I mean, Sabalenka's had one or two bad losses this year, but for the most part, she's been the best player in 2023. So, she lost a two-set match to Kudermetova in like a tight second set, but Kudermetova played really well, and Sabalenka was just a little bit off. But we'll see. That. Also, she didn't play Wimbledon last year, so maybe that's like more motivation for her.
I think there's not a lot of players that take the transition from French Open to grass really well, so. I think it's especially when you're speaking of Wimbledon, it's very hard to like pick a warm up tournament and say this is the one that's gonna gauge it. I think a lot of it depends mostly on how the first couple of matches happen at Wimbledon to actually see like favoritism. It's really hard, especially because the grass season is so short. It's just so hard to predict.
Yeah, and I think another point I want to bring up is that 2021, like I mean, grass is always going to favor the veterans, the ones who are more experienced, the ones who are just, you know, like you said, the players who are just much more, like comfortable on the surface because they've played it for over 10, 15 years and their games just translate really well with the first strike tennis and just like this is not a surface like you can just fake your way through, you know? It actually like you need like a lot of reps. And the fact is, like 2020, there was no Wimbledon and there was no grass season. That hurt a lot of young players. And then 2021, you had a shorter grass season. At least now you have 3 weeks in between Roland Garros and Wimbledon. 2021, you had just two. And then in 2022, you also had all those bans for Belarusian and Russian players. And it's like, so that's like 3 years of like progress that they otherwise probably would have made. At least the ground would be more in terms of, you know, experience and comfort level, but we're kind of best in a mystery. I feel like on the women's side, it's maybe more clear because there's also a lot more players that are more comfortable on the grass. You look at like a Jabeur, you think like Mukhova, you think like, you know, Pliskova with her grass court experience, Kvitova, obviously, Kerber and Halep if they were healthy, but they're not in the mix right now. But like, you know, there's just Jabeur, like there's a lot of, and then all the big hitters like Ostapenko, Samsonova, Alexandrova, like you just have so many players who are just more comfortable, more like there's just a lot more results that they've had on grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, if a bit of a point because you mentioned her name, like very exciting to see Mukhova as the number 16 seed. I think she's she's very really deserved it after a few Grand Slams being unseeded. Very unlucky for Sakkari 2 years in a row, drawing her in the first round.
She's a two-time quarterfinalist also at Wimbledon, and grass is her best surface, even though she got to the finals of
Yeah.
Roman Heroes, which like reminds me a lot of Barty, but
yeah.
But I'm a little bit concerned that she's not playing any warm ups.
I think because of those players
that can just naturally transfer over,
yeah,
maybe.
But I think maybe one of the things that I think of is that it seems like she's so injury prone that she might have thought, well, I just played 2 weeks and my best tennis at the French Open on clay, a very unforgiving surface. Might as well just like take 3 weeks off and just, I don't know, practice, like chill.
Yeah, because you don't want to risk getting injured before Wimbledon. And she's...
Exactly.
Yeah.
What it just said is like her best surface. So I feel like she has like a natural link to that surface, like a natural ability to play on it. So, yeah.
I think so. Actually, that'll be one of my biggest questions in the draw is which of the top four seeds is gonna be slated to face Mukova in the fourth round?
Because
her being 16, that means she's guaranteed to play 1 through 4.
Yeah.
In the fourth round itself. It could be Iga, it could be Sabalenka, it could be Rybakina. I guess. Yeah, it's like could be Pagula. Pagula is also gonna be back in action this week.
Nice, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so the big mystery is like Kvitova, is she going to play this week in Eastbourne and how is she going to do it at Wimbledon? That's kind of biggest takeaway from me.
Wasn't that the question that some people, I think you said like who's going to withdraw first, Ostapenko or Kvitova?
Yeah, I guess we could go to Birmingham where Ostapenko wins another title. And this was impressive. Obviously, we know Ostapenko goes through a lot of ups and downs and in between matches and she hits these purple patches where she's unplayable for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. At a stretch because she just goes so big down the line very, very often and she just crushes your second serve and she's just, you know, not the greatest mover and not the best second serve, but everything else when her game is clicking and it's in that gear, it's just, she straight up bullies her opponent, so let's just say. But
yeah, so that forehand is just, it's just mean. It's like
it's a cannon and she gets so low and she's able to just... Yeah, like, I mean, you'd think she would get no net clearance or topspin, but it's just so hard, so flat, so angled.
Yeah. It's like a very Del Potro.
It's just very tough to just read. You're just at the mercy of her tempo the entire match. It's just very tough to read which she's going to win, what she's going to do. And she's also very unpredictable when it comes to her mood, her temperament. But I will say, this week, she played phenomenally well. She did really, really well to reset in many, many matches and come back from huge deficits. Particularly, there was this one match she played this week. She was out 4-6, love 4, 30-40. And she comes back and wins, and it's just like...
Yeah, she has the ability that she doesn't use incredibly often, but like often enough that when she's frustrated, she's able to channel that frustration into actually playing better. So...
Right.
It as you said, it stuns opponents as well because she starts going down the line, going for broke, oftentimes she will hit the target. So and if she starts hitting the target, she gets more confident.
It's a heady ball too. So it's like it pushes. Not only does it push her opponents back, just the weight of the shot. Because even if she goes hard down the middle, it's like it just knocks you on your back foot. So she's taking so much time away from her opponents on the grass where she gets that penetration just stays so low on top of it, and it's just like I think grass is her best surface. Because like she's gotten to the semis of Wimbledon quarters before, last year made the fourth round, had numerous chances against Tatiana Maria, and then she's won Eastbourne, and last year she made the final of Eastbourne. So those are 2 500s, and then now she's got this title as well.
And
I mean, this week she beat Noskova 3 sets. Venus Williams, who we'll talk about later, in 3 sets from a breakdown in the third. And then that Magdalena Frick match, which is what I was referring to, the 4-6 love 4 deficit. And then she beats Potapova in 3 sets. That's another really good win. And then, of course, the final, which I thought was very interesting, against Barbora Krejcikova. Krejcikova, of course, looking for a big result since that Dubai run, which was one of the best runs I've ever seen to a 1,000 title. But... So she was due for a really big week as well, Krejcikova. She's back inside the top 10, and it was a good week for her, but Ostapenko pulls out. That was the only match Ostapenko won in straight sets, actually, in the final against Krejcikova, both French Open champions. 7-6, 6-4, but the first set was very, very tight. It was 10-8 in the tiebreak for for Ostapenko, and she had to save a set point as well. And both players played very well in the tiebreak, and they were mostly just, it was mostly going according to serve, until the very end when then Ostapenko was up 6-4 and Krejcikova hits this really good block return when they're really deep and gets defends her way back into the point, and then eventually Ostapenko takes it to net. She was actually up 5-1 in the second set, and then Krejcikova mounted a nice comeback and got it to 5-4, and then Ostapenko was able to serve it home with two spectacular points in the end. But I feel like this was much needed for both players.
Yeah.
In terms of a good result, and it puts Ostapenko within that realm of being a super dangerous third or fourth round opponent for anyone.
Yeah.
And then Krejcikova back and won.
Yeah.
In the top 10, but she showed some more fortitude than I'm used to seeing from her. And that was her sixth title as well, so.
This time, yeah. But yeah, since you mentioned her, Venus Williams, like, what the heck is happening again? I think she's something is on her that she's probably just like, let me just like.
She's got a good, she still can time the ball extremely well. She has really good, like, her ball striking is still like second to none.
The serve is also really good as always. So.
Yeah, like the serve just never left. And then also, like, yeah, she just has that, like, anything that comes her way, she has that champion's mentality where it's like she won't stop fighting until the very last point. And she was obviously like hurt to both those matches, and her knees were taped up. She's 43 years old.
Yeah, it's definitely like a moment for her that
the fact that she beat Georgie, which is like seventh, and she outlasted Georgie on one knee, in 3.5 hours.
And she got the super comeback against Ostapenko just to take it to the third set, got a break up, and unfortunately the legs just couldn't take her to the balls anymore. And Ostapenko noticed
that's
that
the only thing. That's a big thing. It's the movement, but everything else is gold and is new. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if she even won a round at Wimbledon in the same kind of fashion that she did against Georgie. Just play some really inspiring, fighting, gritting tennis and scrape out of a four-strong match. The tough part is then to be able to back it up. And it's a bit of a kind of like an Andy Murray situation, although probably more extreme just because she's 43 and she's,
very much.
But...
And the biggest difference, I guess, is like she has the firepower, whereas Andy Murray still has a lot of the movement, but the lacking a bit of the offensive mindset. But
so I mean, that's going to be like one of those feel good stories in the first 4 days of Wimbledon. Undeservedly so, because she's done a lot for the game, and this is her 30th year on tour, and it's just like, imagine being winning 5 Wimbledons and then being the second best in your family. Like, it's
it's crazy. Like, if your sister only wasn't Serena Williams. Speaking of good stories as well, we have one less shot at a tournament. Annette Contaveit announced her retirement. It's been up a little bit in my ear, but she announced an injury in her back, which is career ending essentially. And she's like, what, 27 years old? And
she was number two.
It's a real shame. She used to have like a really powerful game, like a very competitive mindset as well. The best player on tour, like, in essentially 2021, I think.
The second half of 2021 is when she were an absolute terror in the world. Got to the final of the year in championships, won like 4 titles in between, like, was like winning, like, did one of the best indoor players we've ever seen in the last 10 years, no question. And it was really unfortunate because it's like she has lumbar disc degeneration in her back, so like that's like super painful. You can't do any kind of training or competition, and it's and obviously, like, she was a trailblazer in her country as well for Estonia, or in Kai Kanepi, I guess, the Estonian flag. But like, it was sad because obviously, you know, if you watch Breakpoint, you'll see the final, you'll see the Serena's farewell at the U.S. Open, and you'll see that she played Serena in the second round there, and
yeah.
And she got very emotional in terms of dealing with the crowd and the that situation was like really tough for her and made her, and she had a line where it's not, where she's like, I don't know if I can keep doing this anymore. So I feel like that moment combined with everything she was going through that year, because last year was really, really unfortunate because she started the year very well after Australia and she won tournaments indoors, got to the final of Doha 1000 and then lost to Eva. And she was world number two. Like, she was very much like second best player in the world. And then she gets long COVID.
Yeah.
And that derails her for basically 4 months. And then she starts having back problems repeatedly. And like, we knew at the US Open when she was playing Serena, it's like on paper she's number two because of the points. But
yeah,
you knew like her physical state and where her game was at. Like, she was on a downward descent at that point already. I didn't think she was going to retire. So that was very, very shocking to hear. But
but
obviously she's just one of the best players of the past like 3 years. And also like, she's very popular. Like, you could see the reactions from all of her. That's what really got me also, is like the reactions from like Jabeur, Sabalenka, like all those main top rivals that she had. They all like loved Annette and they were like best friends with her. So
It's going to open see that she plays a tournament and it goes out on her own terms. It would be a shame if she had to retire from a match due to that injury. But I mean, yeah, hopefully she's able to stay healthy for
and then play a really nice round at Wimbledon, or like however long. I say round because I don't know how long it'll be, but like,
yeah, exactly. She can play, like, could get a couple of matches, maybe one win, I think would be really
without
good.
Without hurting herself so much to where like she's not able to move the rest of her life, but I don't know.
Oh yeah, exactly. No, for sure. I mean, and she knows what she's doing. She if she's playing another tournament, it's probably because she can do it at least one more time.
It's really sad for sure, because she's just 27 and you feel like she had so much left to give to the game. And
especially nowadays when like players are going over like 30, mid-30s playing.
Yeah, this is like the very peak and prime of her career, like, you know. So and she had a pretty fun game to watch. Like, I definitely enjoyed the matches that I watched in 2021 and early 2022, where like, oh, really, she was taking the ball, liked her backhand, I liked her competitive mindset. She really got so much out of herself in those 6-7 months, and even before that, of course. So she still had a really good career, but obviously so probably had so much more to give. That's like, this is the most unfortunate thing about tennis. It's just so brutal, where it's like, how many players can you name in the last 10, 12 years that are like what ifs, that I could have done so much more, but we're just stopping
exactly
by week in, week out grind of the tour and injuries, and now physical game has become probably a whole other podcast. But anyways, so we obviously wish Annette Contamine the best in the next chapter of her career.
Yep, 100%. And wishing a final Indian Wells a good farewell at the tournament. So, but not Indian Wells, Wimbledon, sorry. I don't know why I had that in my head, but anyhow,
But anyways, And then, of course, we also had Halle, which was won by Alexander Bublik, one of the best runs to a Halle title I've ever seen, because he beat Rublev in the final, and he beat Sinner, albeit via retirement, but he was still playing very well. He beat Zverev along the way, he beat Jan Lennard Struff, and he beat Borna Coric. So these are all Masters 1000 finalists at the very least.
Yeah.
And they're all inside the top 22 of the rankings, and he just dismantled Coric. He pretty handily beat Zverev in the semis and just took him apart with all of his variety and his unpredictability and big serving.
Yeah.
And then he just played a very gritty match against Struff, one of the best grass court players right now. And I'd say players this year in general, because he also made the Madrid final and, you know, nearly won the Stuttgart final against Tiafoe last week. So he was in form. And then the other wins were Sinner and Rublev. The Rublev final was very impressive too, because I thought once Rublev won the second set that he'd probably be the favorite to win the third.
Yeah.
Just because I was like, okay, he's going to just get back into this. He's more reliable mentally, maybe. But Bublik was just absolutely on fire with his serve. He had 21 aces in this final.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. When Bublik's serve is firing, and I don't think it matters much, because like how his mentality is like in rally. Just because he's able to just like win a few points and just be like, okay, I think I got the groove now. And
he hit 12 double floats, but that's because he goes for broke on the second serve, and they pay off a lot of the time because you don't know when he's gonna go 130 or when is he gonna go.
It's a mind game as well.
Like, you just don't know, and then he does that thing where he stands in really close to the service box and he just blocks the forehand return and then retreats back to the baseline, and it's smart because he kind of baits the guy coming forward into the net, and they have to hit a pretty good approach to get it by him because he has underrated speed when he's motivated. And then he can just make his forehand cross court this thing. But that's the key thing for me this week. It's like he's motivated now, and he's back on the grass where like he can play shorter points, and he can
just
like utilize his kind of Kyrgios like skill set to the best degree, because like when he's on clay, then he hates clay, and then he also just was on like a 10-match losing streak during the year. But my main takeaway is like, I for the longest time was just so not invested in this guy.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, why should I be invested in you if you're not invested in getting the most out of your career? Like most of the times he was just like, he was taking it like a job, you know. It was kind of like, you know, he was like, I don't love this thing, but I'm just kind of trying.
Yeah, I mean, which is fine. It's just like
fine because like he was a top 50 guy. He was, but you know, and he still made a couple of quarterfinals and he had won one title in Montpellier last year, beating Zverev there too. But it's like,
it's not somebody.
I just wanted to see him locked in, focused for 1 week, super motivated, and that's what he got. And I just hope he does that more often. So
he's got a really solid opportunity of doing something at Wimbledon as well. Like I don't know how the 5-set format affects his mentality, because the match goes long and maybe that's not something that he enjoys much, but who knows?
Like if he also just totally throws his opponents off when he just takes off a set and then just goes all in for another one, and then just like he can kind of play the format to his advantage if he's smart about it, I think.
Exactly, yeah.
Because he's going to have a few dips where he's not going to be as motivated, but I feel like, I mean, last year he played a good match in the third round against Tiafoe.
Yeah.
Two like entertaining players, and then and the year before that, he lost to Hurkacz in the third round. So he's never been past the third round of Wimbledon, but this feels like the best time. He's playing the best tennis of his career right now. So this week, and I wouldn't want to face him in the third round if I'm one of the seeds, definitely. But the only thing also is it's not anything like scientific or technical or anything, but it's the Halle curse.
Which is,
if you're not named Federer and you win in Halle, you lose first round at Wimbledon. So all eyes on that first round Wimbledon match. I mean, this is one of those quirky stats. Like since 2011, all the players have won.
Yeah.
Like Hugo Humbert, like last year, Hurkacz, Čorić the year before that, Kohn-Schreiber, like players who won it.
I also realized
it also speaks to how different Halle grass is compared to Wimbledon.
True, yeah.
And I think that's the other takeaway also. Because, I mean, Federer just had a grass court game that was just very malleable, and he was just, you know, he's one of the all-time greats. He can adjust anywhere, but that's...
That's better. Yeah,
that's Federer. That's not mere mortals. So, so I think it would be interesting to watch his first round for sure. But also the other thing is he hit 12 double faults in this match.
Yeah,
and he won 48% of his second serve points. So that means if you take away those 12 double faults, he only lost 5 points on his second serve. And for Rublev, he was down in the early 40s, and I think that's what, like Rublev, he didn't play a bad match. He actually did very well to even it up to one set all. But then and then it was 15-40, Love won. And Rublev played two very solid points, got it to deuce. And then Bublik just absolutely attacks Rublev's first serve. And Rublev actually hit a spot very well in the first serve, but like Bublik just nails a return and then hits a backhand cross court winner. And then on the next one, he does something similar, and then he just goes on offense with his forehand and then gets the break, and it's like, wow, too good, you know? And then he just serves out the rest of the game. But in the final game, he hit 3 double faults.
Wow. I'm not sure if it's nervous or he just...
And won ace.
Yeah.
And then won a couple of other points. And then on match point, he hit a second serve ace. The most Alexander Bublik thing.
I think... I have a feeling that Bublik is like one of those players that like plays his... when he's like tight and he's like nervous, like he plays it off as if like he doesn't care, like try to play cool and like goes off for like those huge second serves. Maybe just try to relax or just subconsciously try to relax or something like that. But I mean, you get to a final and then you win. It's not like you don't care about tennis, right? It's like he wants to do well. I'm not sure he realizes how much he wants to do well or how much that he wants to give to to the game or anything like that. But yeah, we'll see. Also, I just wanted to say that I realized that they changed the trophy at Halle. So it's not the same trophy anymore. Maybe they want to break the curse. So new trophy.
Well, yeah.
No curse, yeah.
Break the curse.
Yeah.
They always find it crazy how the Queen's trophy is so huge.
Exactly.
It's like bigger than the majors. And
it almost looks like a montage when you looks like Photoshop at some point. But yeah. I mean, you win a tournament, you win a trophy. It's like, I don't care how big it is. Like, the only thing that, if we're just talking about trophies too much, is that, like, the only thing that I don't like very much is those very artistic trophies. I mean, I am a big fan of classic cups. You know, like, give me Australian Open, Roland Garros, U.S. Open any day, Wimbledon. But like, all the other trophies that don't really look like anything is like sculptures, or the ones that like are just a name written on it. It's just the one that Tiafoe got. I'm not a fan at all. So yeah.
Yeah. Then there's also like the Madrid Open trophy, which just looks like.
Yeah, it's getting interesting by the year.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, we had an interesting week this week. I mean, we have Wimbledon qualifying, and then you have four other tournaments. But mainly the talk is all about the draw on Friday, and I like how they do the draw after the qualies are done.
Yeah, that's nice.
To make, yeah, that's just, it's so much better. I feel like all the slams should do that. But that'll come out on Friday. And then, of course, you also have Fritz. I think he's the top seed in Eastbourne. And then Tsitsipas is the top seed in Mallorca, where he won it last year. So it could be an important week for both these guys, because they had the same schedule last year. And then they ended up winning the title. And then Fritz obviously came pretty close to beating Nadal in the quarterfinals. And then Tsitsipas lost that contentious match to Kyrgios.
Yeah.
The third round, where I felt like the winner of that would probably go on and, you know, get to the final weekend. So yeah, it could be an important week for those two. But and then on the women's side, I think it's an important week just to see how Eva looks.
Yeah.
Just like how she's going to keep adjusting to the grass. Mainly that'll be what I'm looking at. And then we'll see what happens with the, how many players actually want to go all the way in Eastbourne, because it's a 500. And
yeah,
you know, that's the tricky thing about putting a 500 the week before a major, because even if you want to withdraw, you're like, either you just go for it and you withdraw, or you just go all in and you play that week. And that's sometimes not the best. But you'd understand why they're doing it, because 500 points is a lot of points. So,
yeah. And the paycheck is probably really good as well. So,
yeah.
Can't talk bad about that.
So, for some people, it's like, yeah, it makes more sense than you need to lose first round number one. But you also get a pretty good paycheck. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I think that covers everything. We went to all the four tournaments. Had a bit of a rant about trophies. Well, this is mostly just me, but anyways. Yeah, thank you for listening. Thanks much for the talk. We'll be back, hopefully, with a Wimbledon draw preview, if we can, because Sherman does start like 2 weeks after, not 2 weeks, but 2 days after the draw. We'll see how that goes. We'll try to keep doing it. More often as well. Make sure that you follow us on YouTube as well. You can subscribe now. We're going to post those videos up for every podcast now. You're going to be able to follow us in our terrible webcam quality, but it's here. But yeah, thanks. If you're watching us on YouTube, props to you. Thanks so much for the subscribing and the liking and the commenting. And if you're just listening on the podcast, you can always chat with us on Twitter. We're at Tennis and Bagels. Yours is at Vange V2K. I'm at Rollingberg Andre. Owen, again, not here, but he's enjoying his life now. And I think he's in Australia still. But yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Really, really good reason to not be here right now. He's also 16 hours away, which is quite huge. But the time zone difference. So, Owen, hope you're having fun, and chat with us all on Twitter. Owen's, by the way, Tennis Nation. Don't forget to give him a follow as well. And we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you very much. See ya.
Mom. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.